Bem-vindo a mais um episódio do Quem Bebe por Gosto. Este episódio foi gravado durante o Biricera 2025 e é um pouco diferente dos habituais. Trata-se, na verdade, de um workshop técnico conduzido por Chris Lewington, fundador da Brew Resourceful. O Chris é um consultor britânico especializado em eficiência e sustentabilidade para cervejeiras, com um percurso impressionante em nomes como a Thornbridge, a Beavertown e a Full Circle Brew Company. Hoje, através da Brew Resourceful, ajuda cervejeiros e equipas de produção em vários países a melhorar os processos e adotar práticas mais sustentáveis, mostrando que a eficiência e a rentabilidade podem e devem andar de mãos dadas. Neste workshop, gravado ao vivo no festival, o Chris apresenta uma metodologia prática de 3 passos para qualquer cervejeira otimizar o consumo de água, energia, CO2 e matérias-primas, reduzindo perdas e melhorando a margem de lucro. A sessão termina com algumas perguntas do público e respostas bastante diretas, no estilo franco e pragmático que caracteriza o Chris. Se quiseres saber mais ou entrar em contacto com ele, podes encontrá-lo através dos canais da Brew Resourceful, no LinkedIn, Instagram, website ou no podcast que ele próprio conduz. Todos esses links estão nas notas deste episódio. Fica então com este workshop gravado no Biricera 2025, Eficiência e Sustentabilidade na Cerveja Artesanal, com Chris Lewington, da Brew Resourceful.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, David, for having me as well. A total pleasure to be here. It's kind of nice to be in a country that's still warm in September, and also nice to do a talk in the afternoon before I get very sunburned at the beach later on. I spend my entire life at the moment helping craft breweries with their profitability. It's been like kind of a weird lifelong thing that's now transcended into having my own business, going around the world talking about it. I was actually reflecting when I recently talked at a kind of an international sustainability event in the UK. There's AB InBev, Heineken, Diageo there. It was really cool. But I was kind of like, how did I get here? Like, how did I get on this stage to do this? And one of the major things that stood out from my memories was I was at Beavertown and they were handing out projects. Is when I first got there. And everyone was fighting over the dry hopping optimization. Everyone was fighting over the next yeast strain or the next NEPA recipe. And there was a CIP optimization project and I wanted it and I got it and I loved it. And I was like, that's probably really where this all came from. Like, I just love brewery efficiency optimization. But I did my whole career really in brewing. So I've kind of extracted that. Obviously, there's a few brewers here. So my next part is always the audience. Audience participation, but we can just have a little conversation because there's a few of us here. So you guys all work in breweries, right? Or have worked in breweries. When you were there, did you measure brew house efficiency?
Yeah.
And on every batch?
Yeah.
Perfect. And what about electricity? Kilowatt hours, water?
We were doing it.
Great.
We were starting to do it, at least at BEV.
Yeah, so perfect. But this is like kind of like, I guess, I didn't put any hands up, but this is normally what I see, right? So whenever I do these talks, there's 2 or 3 out of maybe 10. So about 20 or 30% of craft brewers are measuring these things. They're really, really simple, and they actually have a huge impact on your cost of goods sold and your profitability. So throughout my career, I've been doing this, but I've actually now turned it into a very basic methodology for people to then use in their own brewery. And it's what I use when I go into any brewery of any size. The methodology is really, really simple, and because I think it's just easier for everyone. So this is kind of the timeline of how it all came along. I started my career at Thornbridge Brewery. For those who know them, one of the most quality-focused breweries I've ever seen in my life. Like, that brew team, it's rare that you see a brew team rule the sales team in the UK, and that's a brew that does that. They dictate what needs to go where, when, and the schedule. It's really cool. Have a great lab. Learned so much. Then I got fortunate enough to move to Beavertown. And when we were growing, we were not looking at our cost of goods sold. We were just growing. So it was all about volume, volume, volume. And we became quite inefficient. But then over the course of the years, we had to look at ourselves internally and become more efficient. And we had those KPIs and we started to look at our cost of goods sold. Then I left and I moved to the Caribbean for 2 years because I got tired of being in London. And I was working on a really, really, really small brewery on a remote island. Resources really hard to come by, all the electricity, everything was difficult, so water especially. And I got to take everything I learned and apply it to the smallest brewery, the most manual smallest brewery I could. And I was like, this makes sense. This is a methodology that can work in all scales from 250,000 hectoliters to 250 liters. So that's when I started my company when I came back, called Brew Resourceful, and I go around helping people with that. Some of the people who use this methodology successfully, so Northern Monk, they saved 7.6 million liters of water a year. Then Barney's Beer, so a small brewery in Edinburgh, we increased brew house efficiency there by 6%. Daya, everyone will know them. We also saved a bunch of water there, like 36,000 hectoliters a year. And Full Circle, where we got their brew house up 8% in brew house efficiency, up to 95%, which is pretty cool. And then I also, I don't know if I actually accidentally put on there, but I also run a podcast as well, which you can see here. I'll probably talk about that a little bit more at the end. But as I said before, these are the five key areas. There's actually a sixth that I haven't put in this presentation, but these are the five areas, and then the sixth would be losses, where I would say you can define how profitable or the COGS of your brewery. So if you can control these five and six metrics, you will have a brewery that can create profitable beer. And they're all incredibly easy to calculate. I'd say probably the only one that has a bit of an issue is the brew house efficiency, because if you're calculating it, you cry the COAs. They come on pieces of paper, quite annoying. But the rest is all like really basic calculations. But what you want to do is, the key is here is the word is intensity, right? So it's not consumption. So how much you consume should be reflective of how much you packaged in that same time period, normally monthly. That gives you what's called an intensity metric. So that flexes with production. So if you ramp up production or scale it down, in theory, your intensity shouldn't move too much, because that's how, you know, you're consuming less water because you're producing less beer. And that's how you can then benchmark it to your internally and externally. We can go, we'll go into how to calculate those in a bit. To be honest, it's pretty simple. So this is the very, very basic start of the methodology, which is baseline, benchmark, reduce. One of the most common problems I see in craft breweries is they skip the baseline, they skip the benchmark, and they go straight to the reductions. The glory, and to be honest, everyone sat here, we will go through the reductions at the end, but that's really what everyone wants to hear. They kind of don't want to hear about the first two, because it takes a bit of time, but you cannot have a profitable, effective brewery unless you do those first two. And that is baseline is basically what we just talked about, which is measuring from the basic level. Then you benchmark internally and externally. So you're looking at yourself. How does that change month to month, year to year? And then you externally benchmark as well. So how are you comparing to the industry standard? And what is that industry standard? And then finally, when you've looked at where you can do, then you can start to reduce. And what it will do is, when you reduce and you have the benchmark and you have the baseline, is you'll learn what in your brewery works, where your inefficiencies lie, and then you can start to apply that to each metric. So it's quite structured, but this is how you can do it that will save you so much time and resources in the future. If you just go straight to reductions, you're shooting in the dark. You have no idea how much it's saving. You don't know if it was effective. And you don't know if that was even the right metric to be reducing. For example, if you think, right, I'm going to reduce my electricity, but actually it's your gas that's really inefficient compared to the external benchmark, you're just wasting your time. So it's a really good way of identifying first where to go. I also have built just about everything on how to do this for free. So I built a brew house efficiency calculator. It's free on my website, Brew Resourceful. And a utility calculator as well. So some people have problems with utilities where they have a tap room, for example, and an office, and then they have one electricity meter for the brewery, tap room, and office. And they can. A lot of people will be like, that's, you know, I can't, it makes my numbers invalid. But I've built a calculator with an offset in there. So you can now put the size of your tap room in, the opening hours, and it will offset the average amount of electricity to give you your consumption a bit more accurately. But what I will say is, offices and tap rooms pale insignificant in comparison to the consumption of your brewery. So even if you can't quite do it, don't be discouraged by having a tap room. It really doesn't actually matter that much. It's really fractional compared to what you actually use. And then benchmarking. So the story of this is interesting, because when I was at Beavertown, we just built a new brewery, we commissioned it, no one cared about efficiency. Then we had to start looking at efficiency. And we were setting water targets. And I think at the time we were at about 7 liters to make a liter of beer. And we set the target for 6.5. And we achieved it. And everyone was like, brilliant, like high-fiving, we've got it, we've done it. And then I started to think, but what if 6.5 is terrible? What if everyone else is 4? Then we shouldn't really be celebrating, we should be doing. And I couldn't find anywhere online outside the Brewers Association, the one in America, that they use things like barrels and quarts and weird measurements that no one actually uses in reality. And I was like, there's nowhere, there's no resource for this. So over the last 2 years, I've been offering benchmarking out for free for any brewery. So you put your data into the Brew Resource website, I'll spit you out one of these reports. And in turn, I have now a database of nearly 200 breweries in Europe, and I can now set the industry standard. So I now know, and I publish it, and I will share with you, what are those industry standards? So you can look, so that you know that if you're at 12 liters to make a liter of beer, you know that you're now inefficient. But this step is really key because, as I said before, this is how you can start to see where to look. So you'll see on this report, you'll have the cost of and then the environmental impact as well. So if I'm looking at this report, I can see the electricity is 49% higher, but it's at this stage is only costing £1,500 a year to hit the industry standard, whereas the gas is 3,700, and actually your CO2, your purchased CO2 over here is £4,500. So that would be where I would start on a brewery of this scale, because that's going to give you the biggest rewards. Okay, what are the industry standards? So should you start to measure, these are the industry standards at the moment for a craft brewery. In the report, you get a specialized one that compares your brewery to breweries of a similar size within it. This is all data. Say breweries ranging from 500 hectolitres a year to about 500,000. In fact, no, there's one for over 1 million hectolitres a year. So there's a really big scale, like breadth in this report. But in your actual one, you'll get much more specific. So this is it. You can see those. They're pretty arbitrary numbers unless you measure them yourself. But I would, once you start measuring, they're key numbers to know. And then how do you reduce? So now we're getting on to the key bit, which is the reduction. Whenever I go into a brewery to do this, and I follow this exact methodology myself when I go into all these breweries and help, the first thing I do is I go around and audit. So for example, if I'm auditing brewhouse efficiency, I will watch a brew the whole way through, from mill all the way through to out, and I'll be recording everything that I can. So I'll be quantifying all the volume. So if there's any volume going to drain, if there's how long everything takes, whether that's, if there's any last runnings going to drain, etc. I will go through and measure everything, quantify it. So then I can start to see where are the biggest areas of wastage and what is that costing that brewery. And then you can start to take the action on reductions. So this audit can take a day or it can take 3. The quantifying is just a spreadsheet. It's really simple to do. And then you can start the action. And you'll see up there, I've got this thing called a prioritization chart. So when you quantify and you get the volume, you can then set a cost and the cost of environmentalism as well. You can then plot that on a prioritization chart and see where you can start. And then you start with the action and the actual reducing. So I've got some key ways that I've helped brews. Well, probably I'd say the most common areas that I see in a brewery for where you can start to increase profitability. Mill, easy. Everyone knows that. Brew house efficiency, the first thing anyone will tell you, go check your mill settings. Like the easiest thing in the world. So I won't really claim that one. Where you really start to see brew house efficiency creep down is in the first and last runnings. So you really need to protect your first runnings. A lot, it's quite common for people to put the sparge on really quickly from as soon as they start exit into the lauter tun or from the single mash into the work kettle. You need to get those first runnings out undiluted. As soon as you start to dilute them, you're actually going to start losing efficiency. Get that bed as dry as you can before you get the sparge on. And then conversely, at the end, last runnings. So this is probably one I see every brewery I've stepped foot in to go and help them with brew house efficiency. This is where they're losing a lot. So you want those last runnings to be almost exactly finishing when you finish your copper at volume. it's quite common for brewers to be really scared, really want to hit their work kettle volume. So they'll just ram the sparge on a little longer, 100 liters, 200 liters. That kills efficiency because it dilutes your work. But then what it's also doing is costing you more hot water. So it's even more inefficient, and energy, because you want to heat that hot water. So that's like a killer. And I know why people do it. And I've done it myself when I was working in manual breweries, where you like got to hit that coffer at volume or that work kettle volume. That's what kills you. But that can translate to like 2-3% efficiency just in that. And then wort losses. So a really good way, if you're measuring brew house efficiency, I would measure it in two places. One, just a classic from COA to fermenter, but then also from malt COA into wort kettle. So that's what's called the mash lauter efficiency. If that's high and your brew house efficiency is low, you can now see that it's actually coming from losses. So you're losing wort volume. Or if it's low there, then you know the mash lauter efficiency is where you need to focus. And the number one way that people lose brew house efficiency is in the whirlpool. The thing is, a lot of them are quite poorly designed, mainly because it's a lot cheaper to have a kettle whirlpool, but then it means it's quite a tall vessel, doesn't whirlpool very well. But also, you need to check the velocity. So it needs to be greater than 3 meters a second in order to create a chub cake. If it's less, you're going to end up with a horrible chub cake. That's a lot of losses. You can lose a few hectoliters, or, you know, 3-4% in there. And finally, if you've got a larger system and you have things like external calandrias, like all of this has to be pushed out with water. I've got a pretty good story for Full Circle. So they had an external calandria and it wasn't getting pushed out with water in between. And you can always know, because they'll always go, it's only a few liters, it doesn't really matter. But it was actually, I looked at the calandrias, 80 liters, and they brewed 200 times a year. So this was the equivalent of 160 hectoliters a year going to the drain. For them, that's 3.5 brews. So the way to frame that is, would you brew 3.5 brews straight to the drain on January? Like, no, we wouldn't. So why are you doing that over the course of a year? So all of these little bits of wort, especially when if you're brewing 200 times a year, they start to look really significant. And that, again, just kills your brew house efficiency over the course of a year. Water consumption. I just tell you now, if your water consumption is over the industry standard, it's coming from CIP. It's just the biggest user. I think over about 40-45% of all water in a brewery is kind of used a lot in CIP. Your key areas are rinse. So you always want to burst rinse over continuous. I'd also say that a lot of it comes down to the optimization. Is your chemical concentration too high? Therefore, you're having to use more rinse water to rinse it out. And finally, how are you standardizing those rinses? So the perfect system is to have like someone testing with phenolphthalein. So just like a little causticity indicator. It can be quite difficult, but you have to set parameters around rinsing. Having someone just say rinsing and then they'll go and do something else, maybe they'll walk over there, like that's where it starts to really to leach out. And then if you've got a brew house, which you're especially an automated brew house, non-CIP flushes, definitely the number two area. So if you've got like a semi-automated brew house and it comes with all the flushing from the manufacturer, those guys don't give up about your water usage. They don't care. The only thing they have to do is make sure the pipe is clear or the vessel's clear. So they'll be using 4-5 hectoliters to heat up a water tun. Like, it's completely unnecessary. Sometimes they'll be using it to preheat mash tuns, or I've even seen like whirlpools preheated, which is just like actually the concept that was completely unnecessary, especially in the craft beer world. So just always those are the ones, especially if you've got a semi-automated or automated brew house. But again, if you haven't, it's all about how long you're flushing for. Are you standardizing those rinse times, or are you letting brewers kind of do it as they please? Because that's where water just starts to really go down the drain. If you have a can or bottle external rinser and that's using water, normally a big user of water. If you can afford it, I'd switch it to ionized air. It's just always it's better, lowers your DO and you don't use water. But the capex of those has come down quite a lot over the last 5 years. I think they're probably relatively affordable now. Then we'll move on to electricity consumption. I just worked in a brewery in the Netherlands in May, and their refrigeration plant was a big problem. So it was designed to be a coefficient of performance of 2. That means for every kilowatt of cooling, it costs 0.5 kilowatt of electricity, or 2 to 1. But they were actually 1 to 1. So that means it was double the cost a year to run the refrigeration plant. Now, the refrigeration plant uses around 40% of your whole brewery's energy. So they've just basically doubled the cost of one of their biggest users. And a lot of that is down to, a bit of it's down to system design, but then there's also just some key points. Temperature of the glycol. Again, a lot of manufacturers will set that to -4 or -3. If the coldest your beer is going is 2 degrees, it doesn't need to be that wide. And for every -1 degree off naught, it's an additional 3% of electricity to run. So we got that back down. We got that down to 0.5 from like -3.5, and that saved 9% of electricity just by changing that one setting, and had exactly the same cooling performance. If you want to assess your refrigeration plant sizing, etc., a really good way is looking at the compressor starts. So if the compressor is starting more than 12 times in 12 hours, it's going to be starting to look like it's running inefficiently. For example, this brewery is 60. So 60 compressor starts in 12 hours. So that thing is just turning on and off. You're losing so much energy when the compressor turns on to when it's off. They're workhorses. They like to be running as much as they can. And it should be only becoming on and off when possible, as little as possible.
Hey, when you're in the country, this is kind of, I don't know exactly the name.
When an electric engine starts and when it stops, generate a kind of energy who came back to the system. Mm-hmm. And in Spain, we have to pay for that energy going back to the system from the stop of the engine. I don't know how.
Really?
Go.
Yeah, I don't know that.
It's a kind of bad energy going back to the system. And then we have to put a kind of dissipador. It's something to absorb that energy, yeah, coming from the engines, instead of bringing back those that energy to the system. Huh. And that brings us a good, important amount of money back every year.
That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I've never worked in a country that has that. That cost. That's really interesting. Okay. I think I understand, yeah. It's kind of funny how unique each situation is as well. So, for example, where the brewery in Netherlands, they had to purchase energy in advance. That was the way that they were doing it. And then they were charged on peaks as well. So if they were using, and they had electric steam generators as well, so it's a lot. So if their peaks got too high, then they had to pay a premium on that electricity above that consumption as well. So we had to do a lot on load shifting. Yeah, that's really, I don't know, I'll look into that. It's really cool. But they're a really big source of energy saps in just about every brewery. I always think that they're like the forgotten child of the brewery, because they're just kind of like left to work in the back. And then you only go and see them when they stop working. But generally they are like a big problem. Another little stupid one is lights, to be honest. Only from my experience at Beavertown, we were having like, we dropped our kilowatt hour per hectoliter by about 7, which is huge, by just turning the lights off at night. It was a big warehouse, but they can be, even LED lights, they're a big user of energy if they're left on. And now I'm going to go natural gas consumption, but this is intrinsically linked to thermal energy. So if you're using electricity or oil, you can just tap that in here. Heat losses. So that's actually mainly on steam distribution. So if you've got a steam generator and you're distributing that steam around the brewery, you have two losses. You have one, a boiler inefficiency. So if your boiler is working inefficiently, you should be around 85% for a gas-fired steam boiler. But some are down at 75, 60. So again, that's just wasted energy, because you have to put more gas in to get the same amount of energy out. And then on distribution losses as well. I would say if I was designing a brewery that wasn't too big, I would do what I could to avoid having a distribution network. So a really efficient distribution network still loses 25% of energy. Your steam's being transported at 157 degrees. It's not an efficient way of using it. If you're only going to put it into the work kettle and maybe one other place. But they're always a big loss.
So, when you say distribution channel, it means that you have your steam generator far away from your brew house and you have to bring it from far away.
Yeah, so if you have a net...
You lose about a third.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and in like a big brewery, the 25% would be like a really, really good score. That's sometimes down to 40%. Also, it depends on how well you're using your condensate, etc. So steam boilers are really good for... they're quite efficient, but it's the distribution that kills them. Same with the condensate receiver, actually. That's what I put there. So when your steam's used, it's condensate, it comes back. But that tank is somewhere between like 90 degrees. It should be around 90 degrees. And I've rarely seen them insulated. So that's actually really what kicks out a lot of the heat. If you're walking into a boiler room and it's like so hot, a lot of it is that 90 degree tank that's just leaching heat. Simply wrap that and that will really increase the efficiency. You'll get 5-10% efficiency increase just by wrapping that. Because no longer is it fighting, especially in the UK, the colder temperatures. And if it's drafty as well. If it's drafty, then it's like another 10% of losses. There we go. We talked about those already. CO2 consumption. So purchase CO2. And in Europe, I believe that CO2 is a lot cheaper per ton. We pay in the UK a huge surcharge. So it's not uncommon for a brewery to pay £900 per ton for purchase CO2. So this is a big problem in the UK, which is why most people are beginning to switch to nitrogen or CO2 recapture. I don't know the price of CO2 in Portugal. Is it? How much?
You should compare to Netherlands, it's like 10
pounds. Yeah, so then I just worked in the Netherlands, it was like £300 or something, or £200. I was like, well, 150 or something. I was like, it's free. Yeah, so it's all about really your CO2 consumption comes down to two things, which is, well, basically purging. That's vessels. If you can minimize tank transfers, ideal. How you purge is always key. And then finally, your specs as well. So I've done a lot of work on purge specifications. We were originally, Beavertown and Thornbridge were at 50 ppb, so which is like 0.005% if you're measuring it on the Halfmans, because that's what we did. But actually, in reality, we were up to about 350, 400, and I've even got it up to 500 in at Gypsy Hillbury when we're doing nitrogen generation, and there's no pickup of O2 in that situation, or DO in that situation. So I think also just changing, having more flexibility around your specifications. So canners are just the big saps.
So just out of curiosity, so you know the reality of the Portuguese breweries, the majority of them, they cannot afford Halfmans to make a O2 reading or a CO2 reading, whatever. You have any advice on how to optimize your purging methods if you cannot read the O2?
It's a really annoying answer. I'd say just borrow one from someone. If you can do it once, if you can basically set the standard once, you don't actually need to measure it every time. If you can borrow it, set your standard and make an SOP and follow it, that's what I would do. I would just go around and find a brewery does have one and ask to borrow it for a weekend, do some purge testing and do it. I think it's really difficult without. I wouldn't even know how you'd potentially even get it to be efficient, or you would just have to do it based on, you would always gonna be inefficient without it. Yeah. Done that before. Yeah, that's no. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, it's actually really difficult, to be honest. If I didn't have one and I couldn't access one, I would do what I could not to move the beer. I would try Unitank. Yeah, I think it's just the safer method for it all, because if it's expensive, I just don't see how it's possible without knowing. But as I said, if you know once and you replicate it, you can just roll with that for a good amount of time and think it'll be fine. Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, that'll do. Just don't move it. And if you're on a canner, then it's the purge times that are really going to get you. But if you don't have a half moon, you don't have a then you don't have a TPO machine, so you can't measure it. So it's, yeah, it's difficult. I understand. One of the most exciting things I think for people who do spend a lot on CO2 is looking at nitrogen generation. So the technology is far cheaper than CO2 recapture. Equivalent value projects I'd worked on recently with Vault City was in for the CO2 recapture somewhere between 120 and 170,000 pounds. And we could get the same nitrogen generator sort of sizing aspect for, we got it for like 25,000-30,000. So a huge capex difference. It's just the nitrogen is often, it's not the perfect gas for brewing. It has real big perks, but in terms of capex, huh? Yeah, it was great. Exactly. Yeah, and you can use it for canning. So they're Full Circle use it for canning. I know that Firestone Walker use it for canning. So it's possible. You just need...
Mixed or pure?
Pure. So you need to look at what they do at Firestone Walker. They go first with a layer of CO2. They start the run with CO2 and then they switch to nitrogen. I'm not entirely sure why. I only discovered that recently.
Any metrics of cost of energy to generate nitrogen versus what?
I do, not on this presentation, but I have that exact number on my laptop. I'll get it for you. It's pretty similar. So the cost with CO2 recapture, the compressor running, because it's a huge compressor, it's a high pressure compressor, and also the glycol. You need to heat it and cool it. So that's probably where it mostly comes in. I remember it being cheaper for CO2 recapture because you've also got the air compressor and the nitrogen generator running, if I remember, but it's pretty marginal. But I've got those exact costs on my
solar panel, for example, if we, and we are importing.
Yes. Yeah, basically free almost. That's the thing with nitrogen. There's two things I would always say to when you're sizing it and conceptually thinking about it. There is it's not like CO2, so you can't liquefy it, therefore you don't have much storage capacity because you can't store the gas. You'll have an air receiver with 7,000 liters in it. It won't last you an hour, so you have to size the unit for the max flow rate per hour. That's what it's there to do. So you need to work out how much nitrogen you're going to use, canning, purging, if you're purging two tanks at the same time, what that is. And the bigger that peak demand is, the bigger generator you need. That's always like where people come a bit undone. It's quite difficult to work out between how much nitrogen, if you know how much CO2, how much nitrogen you're going to use. I always recommend just renting one. So size it up, rent it. Everyone will offer you a rental on nitrogen generators and then see where you're at. It does have some big perks, nitrogen as well. So it doesn't react negatively with caustic. So once you push the tank out, you can go straight to cleaning. You don't have to push it out with air. You don't have to, let it go out. Yeah. And also, it's actually a much safer gas. So CO2 is a toxic asphyxiant, which means it's toxic in low and medium levels, whereas nitrogen isn't. It's still an asphyxiant if you have enough of it. What that means is even medium levels of CO2 before an alarm would go off if you have an alarm system. But if you're emptying tanks into the brew floor, it actually has quite cognitive damage. So it means that your brain is slowing, even though you don't know it. So you might get headaches, your ability to think goes down. It's almost like mildly damaging your brain, even in mid levels. So you've got to be quite careful with CO2. And this would also help move that away. Where it isn't as good is nitrogen is a lighter gas than oxygen. So it makes it actually quite a poor purging gas. And often you have to use a bit more. So I normally factor in about 30 to 40% extra to use. And your purge method has to change slightly as well. So to recap and where you can find all of this stuff, baseline benchmark and then reduce. On my website, I've got free calculators, free utility calculators and logs. Then I do the free benchmarking as well. So you're welcome to submit your results. I'll benchmark it for free. And then for the reduction, I mean, I do presentations like this. I've got blogs, articles, and I also host, I have the podcast, the Modern Brewer podcast. It's not just about brewery efficiency, but it's about all of the topics that I couldn't find research on when I was running a brewery. So we talk about things like hop contracting, CIP optimization, nitrogen generation. I've got like two or three episodes on that. CO2 recapture. I've just done one on refrigeration plants, optimizing and sizing. And then the latest one that's coming out next month, the start of, well, actually the end of this month now, September, we're talking about the stability and the health and safety around NA beers. So there's a common theme now of unpasteurized and even unstabilized NA beers going out in the UK. And there's some really conflicting research around, can pathogens grow? Can salmonella grow? Can things that E. coli, things that genuinely can harm people, can they grow an NA beer? And what are the implications? And how do you make sure that they don't effectively? And we've got one of the leading researchers in the world on it coming on, and Siren. So that's going to be the latest episode, which I'm pretty stoked about. And then, yeah, of course, there's Brew Resourceful as well. This is what I do for a living. So should you need any advice or support or help, my email is chris@brewresourceful.com. And yeah, contact me anytime. And that's it. Thank you so much. Please ask questions.
What I thought about is the yeast we use the the Gosselierian.
I've switched from, I call it pitch and ditch. So you're just pitching dry yeast in and then ditching it at the end. It's actually really easy, to be honest, to re-pitch yeast. I'd always just recommend you have a microscope. I feel like that's a pretty essential. People do it without, by the way, but I mean, I would always recommend one. You can pick them up for £100, a hemocytometer for another £100. And then you can start to count your yeast cells. I think it's quite easy to do personally. It does mess the production schedule up a little bit more, or complex it and makes it a bit more complex. It depends how much you're spending on yeast, really, and how much that's costing your brewery. Yeah, then I'd definitely be reusing. You can just go cone to cone.
Check the viability.
Exactly. Yeah, check the vibe. Just take the first bit off. You can just do that visually. So you'll see when it starts to look creamier and less, like, it's got trub in it. Get that part out, and generally your viability should be good. Go to six generations, you could probably comfortably go to eight. But I would go without much thinking about to six. Make sure you've got yeast nutrient going into, so you've got it healthy, you've got enough calcium in. And then go cone to cone. Or what you can do, if, because you need a flow meter to go cone to cone, or some way of knowing the volume in the tank.
I was trying to understand, because sometimes a problem of re-fermentation can be associated to the yeast.
Yeah, I mean, if your hygiene is good, it shouldn't.
And then that's why I was thinking. Actually, the answer that I was looking for was the generation Europe again or Greek.
Yeah, I think, I mean, depends on the strain, but I would comfortably go to six without thinking too much of it. Eight is where I've seen where you need to push. But I've worked in breweries, Thornwich, were around like 50 generations. So it really does depend on the yeast strain itself and how it acts. But to be honest, if I didn't have any lab equipment, I would do probably a bucket on a scale. I'd always want to pitch the right amount. I think that's the key to consistent beer, really, is pitching the right amount of yeast, getting the same cells in there at the start. Or I go inline flow meter through. And then I just do make sure that my fermentation charts look the same and it tastes and smells good. And that's when you'll get to your generations. When that starts to lag, the fermentation starts to take a bit longer, or you're getting some different smells, that's when I cut that generation. And that's when, you know, I mean, it's crude, but if you don't have the lab equipment to back it up, I think it's a really good, effective way. And to be honest, even in a big brewery, your nose is still the most powerful analytical tool there. So I think just use that.
When we're reading for example, pH, like, you can see, like, if you have the alkyl current, and you can see, like, a pH going straight down and, you know, slowly goes a little bit up, but it, like, I noticed that, like, this year we used, we went to up to 20-something generation, and, like, my boss was like, oh, this is taking a while to the man. I was like, I think it's time to, you know, start it. Yeah. No, you know, continuing, because as you're progressing on the generation to east, you can see, like, all down on the east's vitality, because it's not just viability, because it can be you know, good, but it's not commenting, you know, correctly. And, you know, as well as you go up to the generations, the vitality of the east itself is then, yes, reduced. So I would say, like, look at the pH and how, like, how it kind of goes down, and it could go, like, rapidly up, because that means, like, east, when it dies, or what is it?
Apoptosis, yeah.
Increases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Exactly.
Like, it's not every brewer handled the Mino, so.
They should.
They cost $70.
Yeah, yeah, they should. That's for sure, yeah.
That's the most important things I've been doing.
Yeah, yeah.
The little pitch, the brewery, I'm a magician.
You're a magician. Any other questions? Feel free. It's no problem. Well, thank you very much. And I'm here the whole festival, so please, if anything does come up, please just ask. Francesco's talking next, aren't you, right?
Yes.
At 1:30-ish. But on the stage in the festival.
Yeah, so the talks that are here are the ones that are before the festival. So the one that viewers can attend and support, okay?
Chris, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Availability of coming to Wavy Cider.
What a beautiful place.
This is a try of mine to educate and bring experience from outside to Portugal. I think we need also to step up a bit and put the procedures and a lot of things in terms of brewing, and I think your experience is very valuable.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Espero que tenhas gostado deste episódio e que tenhas retirado ideias úteis para aplicar na tua própria cervejeira ou simplesmente para compreender melhor o lado técnico e sustentável da produção de cerveja. E se queres continuar a aprofundar o teu conhecimento sobre o mundo da cerveja artesanal, não deixes de visitar beerexpert.pt, o curso criado por David Santos e por mim, pensado para ajudar qualquer pessoa a tornar-se num verdadeiro beer expert. Como sempre, se gostaste deste episódio, deixa uma avaliação de 5 estrelas na tua plataforma de podcasts e segue-o para não perderes as próximas conversas, incluindo outras gravações feitas durante o Beericeira 2025. E se não for antes, vemo-nos na próxima cerveja.